This is the CC Radio Podcast.
Welcome, one and all, to this bonus episode of The Countdown. You know who I am. My name is Paul. Not with me today is Wayne because he's off doing things that Wayne likes to do. And instead, I have a long gestating guest joining me today. Someone who, well, a couple of times we very, very close to having him on the show. And then wires were crossed and things went wrong and it never quite happened. And we went ahead, did that show without him. That's one of our most downloaded episodes ever. So thank you for the idea. I'm talking about Jason from the Binge Movies Podcast. Jason, welcome to The Countdown.
Great to be here. It's great to finally not have the wires crossed. And I am sorely disappointed that I was not on one of your most downloaded shows. I don't know how to tell time in Australia. I'm an American. I don't understand what side of the road you drive on. I don't understand how you have a peaceful, non-gun-filled society. And I do not understand the metric system, so I don't know what a kilometer is. Don't get it. So,
and I refuse to work by metric numbers. That's fine. You continue to count 1.6 kilometers for a mile. That's all okay. As long as we get to hear your thoughts on this particular film today, and that film is Palm Springs, the new Hulu original film. We're going to talk all about that in a moment. But before we do, tell the good listeners of The Countdown, Jason, about Binge Movies.
Well, Paul, you've been a guest on Binge Movies. Although originally, like 5 years ago at this point, both of our shows started kind of roughly around the same period of time. We briefly went on a hiatus just over 2 years ago, made a comeback, and have been slowly gaining back our audience, which has been great. Essentially, what we do is we've got two different types of episodes. And we're always kind of mixing it up. We actually binge movies. We watch at least a minimum of 5 films per episode. We rank those movies from worst to best. It's myself and a guest host, or started the podcast with my friend Pat due to the condition of the global pandemic. Pat's got other things he's dealing with now in his life. But we've had a slate of guest hosts, including you. You filled in for us on our most recent season. And then we rank it from best to worst. And then the thing is, we're trying to determine, you know, based on that theme, what is the best movie of that week? And then we compare all of the best movies from all of our rankings to determine what one movie we're going to save. It's a movie death match. It's a movie elimination podcast. We're binging roughly about 25, 30 films a season. We're chopping that all down to one. We're debating it, oftentimes letting our listeners decide on Twitter, at Pat and Jason, and then that movie goes into a no copyright infringement intended vault to be preserved for all time, even beyond the end times. And it's a select few movie that make it into that vault, as you well know.
Do you want to give the listeners one film that's made it into the vault so far?
Yeah, the most recent movie to make it in was 2019's Parasite, Bong Joon-ho, I know you're a fan of.
All right, that seems reasonable, doesn't it? So there's the pedigree that Jason deals with, although on the most
episode. No, here's the thing. When we binge movies, we binge the entire spectrum of films. So there's going to be movies that you've probably never heard of, movies that are throwbacks from, you know, the 1980s, pure nostalgia trips. I mean, we'll talk about something like The Last Starfighter, and we'll praise that movie. We'll talk about a movie like Tiptoe, starring Gary Oldman. You know, we're not above the Neil Breens, the Tommy Wiseaus, or the Bong Joon-hos. We go from one side to the next, the full spectrum of movies, and there's typically not a movie or a type of movie we don't review. One of our long-running series is we do the top-grossing films of the 1990s, which means Striptease is going to be coming up in the not-too-distant future. So, Paul, I might have to have you on talk about that one.
Still be better than Going Bananas. That's all I'll say.
That's right. Yeah, we're not above watching canon films. If Menachem Golem wrote it, we'll review it. That's where it's at.
There you go. So it's across the board. Anyway, if you haven't checked out Jason after today, please go over and head on listen to Binge Movies. I am on the most recent coming up episode by the time this drops, or right around the same time. So
yeah, you're going to be on a couple episodes. So yes. If you're a big fan of Paul, Paul joins us for back-to-back. He's on a double feature with us. And there's classic episodes of Paul. I think the classic episode with you is we reviewed One Missed Call with terrible American horror remakes of Asian films.
That's it.
And we watched some of the worst remakes of Asian horror films, and we did a deep dive feature presentation review, which is another style of episode we do where we just pick a movie apart, and we did One Missed Call, and it's one of our most downloaded episodes ever. So from that era, and I have to assume it's because of the many, many listeners of the Countdown Movie and TV Reviews podcast, which is really sort of the Mount Olympus of movie
podcasts. Yeah, that's it. That's exactly it. Now, if it was indeed helped by my presence, then that should be no exception to this one. And let me tell you, the films we watched this time around, worse than the bad American Asian horror remakes. Just, there you go.
Oh, gosh, yes.
All right, well, let's talk about, what I consider to be a good movie then today, Palm Springs. This is directed by Max Barbacow. It's produced by Andy Samberg and his Lonely Island team, amongst a bunch of others, and the screenplay is by Andy Ciara. Stars Andy Samberg himself, Kristen Milioti, J.K. Simmons, and Peter Gallagher. It's only 90 minutes long. It was released officially at Sundance in January, and from there was picked up by Hulu for a record $17.5 million to start streaming on July 10th, just a few weeks ago. The budget, $5 million, and obviously the box office doesn't really matter when it sold for $17.5, but it did take about $265,000 in a pandemic-infected couple of weeks. Now, Jason, would you like to tell the good listeners what Palm Springs is about?
We're going to try to do this non-spoilery as much as possible, and then we'll deep dive into some spoilers here in the next few minutes. Essentially, what it's about is a bunch of random wedding guests go to Palm Springs, and out in the Southwest, desert of the United States, they gather for a destination wedding weekend. There's some strange things afoot at Palm Springs in a cave. And it ends up being and I think this is in the trailer, so I don't think this is too spoilery. It ends up being a Groundhog Day, Edge of Tomorrow adjacent sort of time loop. But the movie's actually kind of much more than that, and I'm sure we'll get into it. And so it's really sort of a dramedy that's really at the heart of it is really between these two characters, Andy Samberg and Kristen Milioti. So that's really kind of what the film is. It's an exploration of love, essentially, because it's taking place at a wedding. So
yeah,
that's as non-spoilery as I can be.
I think that's a pretty good effort. And as far as it goes, I think Palm Springs is pretty damn good. It was way better than I was expecting it to be. I didn't hold out much hope. It is fair to say there are some very strong parallels to Groundhog Day, as any of these kinds of films will have, but it presents it in a very different kind of fashion. What's your general impression, Jason?
My general impression is there's two ways to do this movie, and both of them are no good. And this movie does a third option, which I really liked.
Oh, okay.
The first way to do this movie is put the time loop concept completely into the forefront.
Yes.
And so it's really a gimmick movie, almost like more like a Happy Death Day to you, which as a movie I've enjoyed, but that's a movie that's really about the time loop gimmick,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
The background, there's another way to do it, which is it's really just a background, which in the United States we have, the Hallmark Channel or Lifetime original movies where every Christmas they'll have some sort of Scrooge sort of movie, but it's really about, wealthy businessman who has to relive Christmas Eve until he learns the true meaning of Christmas and falls in love with a lonely widow or something, a hot widow. And it's sort of like the time loop thing is actually just way in the background, and it's just an excuse for some kind of romance plot or learning a moral lesson. This movie is a third option, which is it changes whether the time loop gimmick or concept or conceit of the film is at the foreground or the background, depending on where you're at in the film. So it's always present, but it doesn't rely so much on the concept, and it also doesn't just ignore the concept just to focus on a dramedy of some sorts. It's not just a setup for some sort of sitcom style humor, and so because of that I think this is one of the most sharply funny, intelligent, thought-provoking, thematically rich movies of the last few years. And it's a complete surprise because it's coming from Samberg's crew, who his style of comedy usually doesn't work for me, and I think this is probably the best performance of his career.
Well, I agree 100%. I think you've hit on what really stuck out for me is I knew the conceit. So I'd read about the Sundance purchase and so had some idea of what was going on here. So as the film opens, I'm straight away aware that Niles, his character's name is in a loop, and this is him waking up on a new day in that loop. Well, it's the same day, if you're on that loop. My partner did not. She had no idea, and I deliberately didn't tell her. So the first 10, 15 minutes of the film, she's laughing, but not sort of sure what's going on, whereas I'm laughing in a knowing kind of fashion. Like, this is why he's swooping in at the right moment. This is why he's looking at her and holding a chair just in time to catch the drunk guy who's about to fall over, because he's done this however many hundreds or thousands of times by this point in time.
Yeah.
Whereas it was really interesting to see my fiance's reaction, which was, she was like, what's this? What's going on? And then, as you say, 20 minutes in the movie, we get the reveal that, yes, he's in a time loop. Now she's in one as well. And that's as far as we'll go in terms of spoilers. But it was a very different way of coming at it, rather than following the person in and, you know, them being blown away for the first time. We get a bit of that from her perspective, but starting with his and then shifting to her perspective is a way I haven't seen a time loop movie done before.
Well, I think doing that, it was a fresh take on it. And then you would sort of, not randomly, but almost at the perfect pace, cut back in between the characters' perspectives. Mm-hmm. And I think what that enabled it to do is it enabled the film to focus on the characters and not so much, like I was saying just a few moments ago, on the gimmick, on the conceit, right? The conceit works because it's interesting and it's one of those interesting ideas. It's one of those what ifs, mm-hmm. but it also works because it allows them to explore a lot of themes about relationships and how relationships end, what our expectations are for new relationships, the life cycle of relationships, and also the life cycle of essentially adolescence. I mean, really, if you looked at this movie, you could say the movie's about prolonged adolescence and how, you know, true adulthood is the acceptance of the banal along with happiness or whatever, and the shedding of cynicism, or maybe being more cynical, yet at the same time kind of having hope, you know. And so I think the moral message of the movie, if there is one, is maybe a little bit more schmaltzy than it lets on, but it presents itself in such an understated way, just like with that gimmick, you know, of the time loop thing, or the conceit of the time loop thing. Even that's done in kind of an understated sort of way. It's appropriately goofy in the right spots. It appropriately changes point of view at the right spots. It appropriately knows when to shift the tone, when to shift the focus more on, okay, the time loop thing, and why are we in this and what's happening, and when to shift away from it. And so I think what it really comes down to is it's a very masterfully put together script. And then you have this really, really solid cast who everybody's giving amazing performances. Melody's been great in everything she's ever been in. She's famously in one of the Black Mirror episodes from the last few seasons. It's sort of a take on Star Trek and toxic fandom. And
oh, right. Weird, yeah, I didn't recognize
that. Masculine,
yep.
Weird pervert stuff. She's in that episode. She was the mom on How I Met Your Mother.
Yep.
Spoilers. And she played one of the writers on 30 Rock, who was infantilizing herself, jumping a trampoline with a little crop top with her boobs bouncing to get the male's writer's attention. And she was like an antagonist to Liz Lemon. And that's where I first saw her. And she's been great in everything she's ever been in. And she's really good in this, playing kind of a offshoot, almost Manic Pixie Dream Girl type. But there's more to her than that. And
oh,
Adam
definitely.
Sandberg's kind of playing this. Any one of these characters could have been one note. This movie could have been one note. It could have just been a gimmick. It could have just been kind of a raunchy time loop movie. It could have been really, really dumb. And instead, because it knows when not to pull punches and when to shift gears and all that sort of stuff, ends up being really smart. I was surprised at how smart the movie was, as well as funny and interesting.
I 100% agree. I think this film tonally balances out perfectly. It, as you say, it could have become slapstick custard pie around this, which...
Yeah.
You know, I might lose a few fans, I say, but that's how I feel like Groundhog Day ultimately becomes. I know it's got a stronger message than that, but it pulls back, like you're saying, and it shifts to being a bit more of a serious consideration of really how would you cope if you were stuck in the same day over and over? And they're contrasting, because he's been around in this for a lot, lot longer, so long that he's forgotten what job he used to have, that's a fascinating line. It opens up all these philosophical kind of, maybe that's not the right word, but consideration of how would you survive psychologically. For me, that's the most fascinating question here, when you're just doing it over and over again. And and they have fun with that, and they play with that, and they give sort of, you know, montages of some of the things he's done, and that's funny and that's entertaining. So there's the comedy element, but then there's that more serious consideration of being stuck there and how one person has learned to accept that. And it's like, well, this is it. This is the way it's going to be for me forever. And the other person is like, no. You know, initially, there's a period where she sort of gives up and leans into it, but then things happen, which we'll talk about in the spoiler section that we'll get to in a moment, that galvanize her to move in a different direction. And I really like that contrast between the two of them, because he's a typical Andy Samberg character, really. You know, he's kind of goofy with a serious kind of center at times. He's toned
down a little bit from, yeah, you know, like Dick in the Box or whatever. But yeah, he's a typical kind of loser.
But he's very likable
character.
Very likable.
But likable, yeah, yeah. Very likable, yeah.
Whereas she's much rougher around the edges. She's sardonic. Mm-hmm. She's very intelligent, but she's kind of pissing her life away. And that's a different take on a female character in this kind of film. Yeah. Normally that would be reserved for the male. So I like the way that they kind of flip that around a bit. And as you say, she's very good.
In a previous generation, she would have been played by Winona Ryder.
Yeah.
If this movie had been made, it probably would have been Christian Slater and Winona Ryder.
I could see that. I'd like be behind Heathers. That too.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously 20 years ago, but yeah, or 25 years ago.
Right.
But that's what I really liked about it. And there's some side characters who really add to the fun and the proceedings, but again, they're probably more spoilery. So look, I think this is a hard recommend from both of us, but we'll get to scores and whatever at the end. Is that fair to say, Jason?
It's definitely a recommend for me, and I seek it out. Because if you're looking at it and you're like, man, I've seen a lot of these time loop sort of movies now, it's a lot more than that. And it's a very rich text, honestly. And I think we'll get into a little bit more of the thematic and spoilery elements in the next part of the review. But I would recommend the movie, and I would recommend you don't listen to the second half of this episode.
Absolutely,
you've seen the film.
Hit stop. Come back if you want to after you've watched the film. But you now know that two different podcasts are thoroughly recommending it. And this is easily sitting on my top 10 of a very, very bad year for film, for obvious reasons.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the... I want to say it's one of the best movies I've seen in 2020, but that's faint praise in 2020. Yeah. This has been the year. This is the darkest timeline. This is the year from hell. We're all going through it together.
Yep.
Yet this is still the cream of the crop. I mean, it's this and what? Bad Boys for Life? I don't know.
Yeah. Yep. Pretty much. I would say that's accurate. All right, then. I'm going to hit the spoiler button, and then let's get into it in more detail on the other side of this. All right, Jason, now you can go hell for leather. What else did you love about Palm Springs?
I'm going to go into theme, because thematically, I thought the time loop is maybe the perfect description. When we meet Andy Samberg's character, he is so over this toxic, empty relationship that he's in with this mindless woman who doesn't even like him, clearly is not interested in him.
That was a very funny
moment. He's not interested in her. Yeah. He's not interested in her because he's been there for decades, probably, if not longer. But yet it's at the same time it works on a time loop level, it works as an examination of where you are with somebody at the end of a relationship. It's a relationship of convenience. She needs a wedding guest, and they go do these sort of things together. And that's why they're together, because they've been together for a few years at this point, and their lives are just enmeshed. And so they just stay together out of convenience. Yet it works on that level. It also works on a time loop level, because he's had sex with her that same morning for decades, probably. It's to the point where he can't ejaculate. He can't even masturbate. There's nothing there for him anymore. So we go from that into this, you know, like I said, prolonged adolescence, where it's really what the movie is, because they drink everything under the sun. They do every drug under the sun. Mm. They have every experiment of every form of sex and sexuality under the sun. And it's kind of played for comedy. And
in a really well-edited scene.
Perfectly well-edited. And he's just sort of come to the conclusion that this life is meaningless. Love doesn't really exist. We are alone in the world, which is a very cynical kind of adolescent thing. And the movie kind of ends in the note that even ideal happiness is a form of misery and banality, but it's banal, but it's not empty. Because we get to the point where, you know, Melody's character she's growing, she's evolving, she's changing, she's bettering herself. She's ready to leave adolescence and self-destruction and go into the future, right? To grow up, essentially. And he wants to stay, right? I love you, but I want to stay a boy. And she's like, you might only love me because I'm your only choice.
Yep.
Right. And so what's great about this movie is every line in every situation, you know, the meet cute, the development of their friendship, then them finally having sex. It's all When Harry Met Sally sort of classic rom-com dramedy sort of stuff. But it works on both levels of the traditional rom-com level better than most rom-coms and with a sci-fi high concept. And so are they talking about the time loop? Or are they talking about the relationship? Because after the first time they have sex, they have this amazing experience with each other. You know, they're staring at each other. They're deeply in love. The day repeats. And for reasons I won't fully get into, in case somebody was foolish enough to listen to the spoiler section, I'll save that one. You know, she's now acting completely strange and weird and pretending it was no big deal, which is oftentimes what happens when you transition a relationship from friendship to sex. But it's never done in a way where it feels like they're beating you over the head with rom-com staples, even though they are touching upon all those things we've seen 10 million times in a high concept we've now seen 10 million times. And yet it all feels fresh and it works on both sides of the page. And it's amazing. It would have been so easy to screw this movie up and to screw up the last act of the film, especially. And they didn't do it. They executed it flawlessly, I think.
I think for me, what you said there sort of triggered off a metaphor, and that is somewhere, someone once took peanut butter and jelly and went, these two things are really good by themselves. What if I put them together?
Yeah.
And the way you describe that there, it's a rom-com, which, all right, lots of people love rom-coms. I'm not the biggest fan of them. And then a high-concept sci-fi film and stuck them together. And the result is elevating both. Like, if this was a straightforward, serious time loop film, it wouldn't be as good. If it was a straightforward, like you say, played as a straight rom-com, which just happened to have a time loop element in it, that would suck as well. But together, these two things are so much better. The sum of their parts is so much better than the parts themselves, if I could put it that way.
Well, think about how many generic and lackluster or downright awful high-concept sci-fi movies come out.
Lots.
And this easily could have been Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence and Passengers. That's one version of this movie. That's one version of this movie, right?
That's a really good comparison.
It could also have been a really bad rom-com that, you know, Rose Byrne probably would have started. And I like Rose Byrne, but she's been in a lot of shitty rom-coms. It'd been like Jason Bateman and Rose Byrne or something, and it wouldn't be any good. And yet somehow they've taken these two genres or subgenres that are kind of difficult to execute on a high level and have executed them both. And at the same time, like I said, I think the movie ends kind of in a place of accepting the monotony of a long-term relationship. Like there's a line, and it's been a minute since I've seen the movie, but there's a line towards the end of the film where she's like, what if we get sick of each other or something like that? And he's like, we're already sick of each other. Yeah. That's the best part.
And I still want to be with you. Yeah.
And I still want to be with you. And I think that's
emphatic
the thing is
period.
Like, emphatic period. Yeah. When you're a child, everything's hedonism. Everything's the height of pleasure, drugs, alcohol, drug, sex, rock and roll, whatever, relationships. They all have to be ultimately fulfilling at all times and can never be boring. You're just jumping, especially if you're mature, jumping from person to person to person, trying to ride that high. Whereas adult relationship, you have to be a little bit more cynical about it. And yes, you realize it's not the storybook and everybody's got their baggage and people fuck up and you're going to get sick of each other. And there's times it feels like a time loop because you're reliving the same day over and over again. And you don't want to be near that person, but that's kind of what real love actually is. And so I don't find the movie completely cynical because I think the characters arc in a way that's both believable, but kind of endearing and kind of hopeful. I think the movie ends on, like, if you could be sardonic and hopeful, I think that's what this movie is.
Well, they both changed each other for the better. And I mean, that's a rom-com trope that works here as well. And I think we should mention the third member of what's going on here, which we have avoided for spoilers, and that's J.K. Simmons as Roy.
Fantastic.
Just a great, I mean, it's almost a glorified cameo. He's only in it sort of three or four times, but when he just lights up the screen. And his take on being dragged into this, because he went on a cocaine bender with Niles at one point at the party, and then, hey, I want to show you something. And then his reaction is, well, I'm going to murder you forever for trapping me for this one day. Right. Because you're denying me, as he eventually explains, I thought you denied me the right of watching my children grow up, and I was very angry about that.
Yeah.
But, you know, ultimately he comes to accept his situation as well and realizes that it's a perfect day to be stuck in because his family's at a perfect age and no one's sick and they're never going to die and he'll always have them. And so he makes his peace in that way, which, again, I like that little arc that he has, right down to the fact he says, oh, traffic's a bitch. Can you just kill me so I can wake back up again the next morning?
That's exactly right. Can you kill me one more time for old time's sake?
Yeah.
I think what's great about the J.K. Simmons character is his character really brings, even though, yeah, it's a glorified cameo, his character in that, the Irvine, everybody needs an Irvine, really brings everything together in that scene where he's like, I didn't have a good relationship with my wife. I didn't appreciate my kids. My kids watering a turd. You know, my daughter's whatever, you know, whatever. Like, yeah, like he went to this wedding as some distant cousin to go get fucked up because he felt his life was miserable, right? Yep. I mean, like when we first meet him in the flashback or whatever, he's sitting there like, you know, marriage is, it's the worst. It's like, it's the bottom. It's rock bottom. Yep. It's a dark, deep well of pain and suffering. When we finally get to him, he's like making salmon for the family and they're like this picturesque, suburban, you know, upper middle class family, and he's like, I learned to make peace with it and learned, like, basically I've got to be a better person, I've got to be a better father, I don't have it as bad as I thought I did. I need to learn to appreciate what I do have, and because of that, like, you know, I'm a better man, essentially. And I think that's the summation of the movie, right? That's where Sandberg's character has got to get in order for him to preserve the love that he is burgeoning between him and Melody's character. He's got to leave the safety of what is the known and the comfortable, which is what every relationship is. Every relationship is you are leaving the safety of kind of living for yourself selfishly, sometimes nihilistically, narcissistically, in singleness, and you choose to let go of that to take the risk of being with somebody. And it doesn't always work out, but it's worth the risk, I think this movie is trying to tell you. And it's wonderful. And I'm hoping, I got two theories out before we get off of here. I want to know what you think, okay? Theory number one, that mid-credit scene, I'm hoping that J.K. Simmons is able to find his way out of the time loop. Do you think he will make his way out of the time loop?
Well, I think, 100% he will, because Niles told him what Sarah's plan was, and
she left a voicemail for him, right? With instructions how to do it. Yeah.
And so the implication was he had told Roy this. And so Roy goes up to Niall and sort of taps on the shoulder and starts spouting off about everything. And then Niles looks at him like, who the fuck are you? So that implies
it's not the same version of him. Yeah.
Yes. And so he realizes this is true. This is going to work. So either if he hasn't already, because I wasn't even sure if maybe he already had blown himself up and that's when he's walking in, or he now knows that if he does blow himself up in the golden light or whatever it is, the ball, he'll be out. So he has a choice now, if he hasn't already, when he wants to do that.
My next question is, Nana or Grandma, whatever her name was, she in the loop?
Yeah, that was a really good little question.
The first time we see her, she's like, I've been to millions of weddings, and of all the weddings, that's the best way to be. And it's an innocuous line. Yeah,
and you think
it's the sort of shit Grandma say at weddings.
Yeah,
yeah. Then she turns to her granddaughter and says, I know you're going to be leaving soon or whatever. I just want you to know that I love you and I'm proud of you, or whatever it is that she says to her, almost alluding to the fact that, like, I know what your plan is. I know you're going to get out of the cave, out of the loop. So do you think, was I reading too much into that, or do you think she's in the loop?
I think they deliberately are leaving that there for you to determine. Not with the first comment, but when they circle back around to it at the end of the film, they're dangling that as a, hey, you interpret this how you will. And I think that's fun that it works both ways. You can be interpreted as this is just a typical grandmother who's loving and caring and recognizes that her granddaughter needs a little bit of a push. Like, you know, I know after this wedding, you're going to get out there and do something different. Or it could be that, somehow she stumbled into this loop as well and she knows all about it and is just like saying, sounds like you're out of here. Good on you. good luck.
Just the way that the shot lingered on the grandma, and she had sort of a knowing look on her face, and the way the reverse shot on Melody lingered, where she kind of got wide-eyed, because it was almost a callback to when Sandberg was giving the wedding toast and he was specifically addressing her.
Yep.
It was almost like a little bit of a repeat of that. And that's why this movie is so freaking smart, because so many of the situations and the dialogue work in ostensibly both films, right? They work in the rom-com world, they work in the time loop world, and they could be taken either way and both ways, and they provide a great commentary on adult and human relationships and romance and love in the age of destination weddings and dating apps.
And it just, to be very simplistic for a moment, it's just funny throughout. Like, too many of these comedies peter out by the halfway point and become very saccharine stained and all about the romance side of it, and you get maybe one or two laughs in the last 45 minutes of a rom-com. Yeah, sure, it's not quite as funny after some of the big montages, particularly the one where they are embracing the horror, so to speak, and just doing ridiculous shit, like having a big dance-off in the middle of this redneck bar, which is hilarious. But even towards the end, even in his final speech to her, that, like, that emphatic period, oh, I didn't mean it that way, you know, that's good stuff. It's good writing. You're really on board with these characters. By that stage, I was really rooting for him and her to get together, and I can't say that about too many rom-coms. Normally, I don't give a shit. I'm annoyed at the waste of time that I've had. So this is getting a big boost for me, because it's in a playing around the edges of a genre, or really playing in a genre that I don't normally enjoy. And this one captivated me, and I can't see how anyone wouldn't like this movie. It's just one of those, it's got appeal for everybody.
There's a couple of jokes at the very beginning that I thought were a little, I don't want to be a puritanical, there's like a little crude to just kind of, I'm like, oh man, if this is what it's going to be throughout, this movie could really be obnoxious. And also, in a lesser movie, both of these characters, who are toxic as fuck people, could be very, very obnoxious. I think there's the wedding guest or destination wedding or whatever with Keanu Reeves and Winona Ryder that a lot of people didn't like, because that was their sum total, was these are two toxic people. I had just gone through a divorce, so I found that movie to be wonderful. I don't know if upon a revisit if I would like it as much. By the end of this movie, well before the end, I should say, I didn't find these people annoying in a way, because I didn't feel like their annoying traits were being glorified. I think it was more of an exploration of, these are two fucked up people, and they're having to kind of deconstruct for themselves what's wrong with them, if there's going to be any chance of them getting out of this repetitive loop. So you could say this movie's about self-destruction. You could say this movie's about, both of them have drug and alcohol issues. You could say it's about addiction. You could say it's a movie about toxic relationships. You could say it's a movie about prolonged adolescence. You could say it's a movie about the repetitive nature of long-term relationships and marriage. You could say it's about, and one of the other things I appreciate is, here are two actors who are firmly in their 30s, maybe even approaching their 40s.
Yeah, he's 41.
As a single guy in his 30s, you know, dating around and stuff, you know, it's different dating in your 30s than it is in your 20s, because, you know, the bloom's off the rose a little bit and time is running out, and, you know, everybody's got some shit. You know, everybody that's left is, it's like the scratch and dent bin at the local discount supply. Tractor Supply, right? That's what it is. Like, so everybody's got a ding in them. Everybody's been married or has a kid or has been divorced. We've all been through long-term relationships that have failed. So they were a little bit more cynical about life and about love. And so to have a movie with two adult characters functioning as dysfunctional yet still likable characters, who actually the growth is believable and not suddenly dramatic, and they're not having these some come to Jesus moment. It's never saccharine. It never gets into too much schmaltz. Yep. And yet I think the movie has a very good heart underneath all of that cynicism and out of that crudeness and that, you know, drug humor or whatever, sex humor or whatever, penis jokes and whatnot. There's an almost an innocence to the film. It's lightning in a bottle, I think. That's the best way to describe the movie. This movie could have gone wrong at any turn, and
so
it
many different
didn't.
Ways, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, the other thing, last thing for me that I wanted to mention is, I like the fact that there is actually, in a pseudo, obviously not really explainable kind of way, there's a scientific explanation for what's going on, that they use science to sort of, so to speak, get themselves out of it, rather than it being kind of like an act of God or just it's meant to be. So I like the fact it's a bit more grounded in that way, which is how they ultimately end up moving through this time loop, shall I say.
Yeah, and it's the female character who discovers it after presumably decades of studying theoretical and quantum physics. Yep. Without any help whatsoever from Sandberg's character, which I thought was great, great touch. And it's also not like beating you over the head of like, yeah, feminism. It's just a really smart character, spends a lot of time studying and figuring shit out because she's stuck in a time loop. And I think that's wonderful.
That's it. All right. Well, we score on our show as you do on yours, Jason. What would you give if you can do the conversion to 100? Take the decimal point out. what would
is
you
that part of the is that part of the metric system? I don't understand what you're saying. Are we grading these movies in kilometers?
Sure. Out of how many hundred kilometers would you give Palm Strings?
I don't fucking have any clue. I would give this movie a 97 out of 100.
Wow. Okay, that's
in my world. That's in the imperial system. That's a 9.7. I give it a 97 out of 100. I think it's one of the most refreshing movies I've seen in a very long time. And the fact that it's accessible to most people in many parts of the world via Hulu, it's worth that month's fee for Hulu Plus. I mean, it's just a wonderful film.
Well, I grade everything. That's our listeners are aware. I grade a bit harder than that. You two give out nines on your show like they're candy.
Oh, whereas fuck off. We do not.
Also,
Wayne's
give out
not,
very
Wayne's not here. Story. Wayne's not here, so somebody on this show has to tell you to fuck off at least once. Bite my ass. Bite my whole asshole, or whatever he says. Eat my ass.
I give this one an 83, which comparatively, given the way I score, is a very good score. And
well, goddamn, for Negatron, 83. That's you might as well just give it 100%. I listen to your show. I know that you hate movies.
Exactly. That's why I do this every week. I hate movies so much.
You do it every week because it gives you a chance to take out your aggression on the thing that you hate the most.
That's it.
I do it for love. As you can tell. Do it for hate. That's the difference between you and me.
There you go. 97 and 83. My math's not the greatest, but I reckon that's a 90 average score, and that's one of the highest we've ever given on this show. So if you haven't checked out Palm Springs...
I'm glad I could set a record around here. Come on. USA! USA!
Check out Palm Springs. Get Hulu. Or, you know, wait for it to land on some other platform. I assume maybe you can get it on. Maybe you can't get it on Apple Plus and things like that yet. But I'm sure it's coming eventually once Hulu has its exclusive $17.5 million worth of a deal finished. So thank you, Jason, for joining me today for this review of Palm Springs. It's been a pleasure. We'll have to get you on for an actual top 10 at some point. Hopefully you'll be down for that.
Oh, for sure. I'd love to be back on the show. Your listeners, if they didn't find me too obnoxious, too verbose, they can find me on Twitter, frequently engaging with Paul. I'm at Pat and Jason. And we're also on every platform conceivable. Some of our catalog is missing from Spotify. I have no idea why. We're available on Spotify. If you're in the U.S., Google Podcast, of course, Apple, Stitcher, Spreaker, TuneIn, wherever you listen to podcasts, we're there. Podbean, which I know the countdown, you guys are on Podbean.
Yep.
We're on, it's a really good ass app or something like that for podcasts. We're on there too. And so find us on there, subscribe, rate, review, and tell us that the countdown sent you. And that we'll know where you came from, and maybe we'll give you a shout on the show.
Sounds good. All right. And you know where to find us. Search the Countdown Movie and TV Reviews. If you don't, we'll pop up in all the places that you can find us. But as Jason mentioned, we host on Podbean, and you can check out ccradio.com.au. for a bunch of other great Aussie shows as well. And the links in the show notes to the Facebook list community, where if you're on Facebook and you want to get involved with conversations about the movies that we talk about, and indeed all other things, movie and television, the link is there for you. All right. Thanks so much again for joining us today. Palm Springs is great. Check it out. My name is Paul.
My name is Jason.
And this has been The Soundboard, although it hasn't featured very much today because it's not live with me.
Vindication!
We will catch you next time. Cheers.
Binge on.
Ha ha ha.